Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. These are the words of the 19th Amendment, ratified August 26, 1920, which means that this year we mark the 90th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. It's not that long ago. It astounds me to think that my grandmother, who was a suffragist, could not vote for a while. This hour of the program, we have two great guests, and we're going to be talking about the long, long struggle to get women the right to vote in this country. We'll have two guests with us. Sally McMillan is Mary Reynolds Babcock Professor of History at Davidson University and author of Seneca Falls and the Origins of Women's Rights Movement. Professor McMillan specializes in Southern and women's history with an emphasis on 19th century. Her publications include Motherhood in the Old South, Pregnancy, Childbirth, and Infant Rearing, Southern Women, Black and White in the Old South, To Raise Up the South, Sunday Schools in Black and White Churches, 1865 to 1915, and Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement, and that was published in 2008. Professor Sally McMillan, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Are you there?
I'm here.
There you are. Hi. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah. Also joining us this hour is Christine Lidbury, who's executive director of the Wisconsin Women's Council. And she presented a very interesting history of Wisconsin women in this women's rights movement. She was presenting remarks at the Janesville Women's History Mural Dedication. If you haven't seen this, and I haven't seen it yet either, it is in Janesville, and women in Wisconsin, and men as well, have a really proud history when it comes to the 19th Amendment. Christine, executive director of the Wisconsin Women's Council, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Yeah, great to have you here. You know, the first thing that just always knocks me over is that this was not very long ago. When you think about it, I mentioned my grandmother. My grandmother couldn't vote. My grandmother. It was a long, long struggle and fairly recent, the 19th Amendment, wasn't it, Professor McMillan?
Yes. Hi, yes. It's also surprising. Not only does it seem fairly recent, but the fact that it took 72 years for women to get the right to vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an incredibly long struggle. That's basically two generations of women who worked so hard to get us the rights we have today.
Mm-hmm. Christine?
Well, you know, when I was working on this presentation, it occurred to me that I have an aunt, a great aunt, in Walworth County who's 92 years old. So she was born before, you know, this amendment passed. It's really remarkable that there are people in our communities today who were born before women had the right to vote.
My mother being one of them. Yes.
Hmm.
It's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. And tell me a little bit about the mural. What's in Janesville?
Oh, it's a terrific mural. You know, Janesville has several history murals around the city, and all of them, most of them until this one, had, you know, leading characters as men. And a coalition of women got together, actually dedicated to a woman named Judy Neese, who passed away last year, and who was a great advocate of women and women's history and education. And it's a huge mural on the front of the Rock County Courthouse, and it memorializes women's contributions to that community between about, I think it's 1860 and 1890.
We'll have to see it. Was it just
it's beautiful?
Yeah, we'll definitely have to see it. Let's talk about this long struggle for a moment. 72 years is a long time. Gail Collins made reference to all of these referendum campaigns to get legislatures to submit suffrage amendments to voters, 47 campaigns to get constitutional conventions to write women's suffrage into state constitutions, 277 campaigns to get state party conventions to include suffrage planks, all of these campaigns. Why start with the beginning of this struggle, and then please tell us why you think this struggle was so long. Let's start with you, Professor McMillan.
Well, of course, there were a few rumblings about women's rights going back to the American Revolution. I mean, we all remember Abigail Adams saying to her husband, John, Remember the Ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some writers who began to articulate their concerns about the fact that women were not citizens, and yet here we have the Declaration of Independence and this fight for freedom and democracy. So, you know, some of the concerns predate Seneca Falls, but the Seneca Falls Convention in July 1848 was the first major sort of meeting to discuss the grievances women had and to make demands for change. And that convention was organized by five women, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, who continued to work, you know, so hard for women's rights. And then they were joined in particular by Lucy Stone and Susan B. Anthony. And the resistance to women's rights was just relentless. Ministers opposed it because they had a certain perception of women's inferiority. There were, of course, many male politicians who opposed it. They did not want to share their power. Neither political party saw it to their advantage to give women the right to vote, because women would vote, you know, who knows how they would vote. There was no predicting. And just concerns about women, you know, being, you know, they're supposed to be in the home. They're supposed to be silent, submissive, and their role was not in the political world. So these ideas just continue to resonate. And I think, though, the most discouraging thing of all in this struggle was the fact that many women began to oppose women's rights. They very much feared this idea of power and engaging in the political discourse. So the resistance was just overwhelming, and what I'm always struck by is how these women never gave up,
mm-hmm.
despite the hurdles they faced. They're amazing.
Yeah, they are amazing. And it's my understanding, tell me if I'm reading the history correctly here, that the Seneca Falls, there were a list really of grievances here, but there was a bit of controversy as to whether or not to include women's right to vote as one of the grievances and to start a movement, that some thought that this was just going beyond where they ought to go.
Oh, it was extraordinarily radical. I mean, even Lucretia Mott confronted Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was the one who really insisted on including this among the many grievances. You know, she just thought that was going too far. But it was Frederick Douglass who saved the day when they were actually voting on this. Yeah, and Frederick Douglass, of course, the fugitive slave who was now publishing the North Star, the newspaper in Rochester. You know, he stood up and saved the day by saying, you know, if I'm going to fight for the rights of African Americans, I'm going to fight for the rights of women, and they deserve the right to vote as well. So this very radical idea of women as voters actually passed, as did all the resolutions and demands for change.
And then became the focal point, right?
It did become the focal point. There were lots of other issues, but certainly in this Declaration of Rights and Sentiments at Seneca Falls, but suffrage became the issue because women realized that if they couldn't exert any political power, they were going to not be able to see any major changes in their lives.
Mm-hmm. And what about here in the state of Wisconsin? Did we have a progressive view of all of this, Christine, or did it take some doing here?
Well, it did take some doing here, although I think you can go back as early as the 1840s, early 1850s, to find women who were advocating. In 1855, there was a bill in the Wisconsin state legislature to grant suffrage, roundly defeated. As little as 10 years before the 19th Amendment passed, a bill to grant suffrage in the state constitution was defeated. Wisconsin, we can talk about this later, probably was the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment. But really, it's kind of ironic that that's the case, because there was not a lot of support for women's suffrage. Women's suffrage was very closely linked to the women's temperance movement in Wisconsin early on. And that really drew a lot of hostility from legislators, from a lot of the companies in Wisconsin that dealt with the brewing industry. And really, it wasn't until women got much more involved in the public school reform campaigns that it became much more palatable to make male policymakers to have women kind of be part of that dialogue and discussion. And women early on got some rights to vote in elections pertaining to school matters, although this became a little muddied later on.
Mm-hmm. And this was one of the concerns nationally, too, wasn't it, that if women got the right to vote, Professor McMillan, the temperance movement was going to grow and women were just going to get rid of alcohol?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was sort of the major reform movement of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And there was, you know, widespread concern that women who were such strong advocates of temperance or prohibition would actually, you know, basically do away with alcohol. It was only with the passage of the 18th Amendment in 1919 that made that a moot point, but that's only a year before we have the passage of the 19th Amendment. So that was an ongoing concern, not only in Wisconsin, but I know in the South it was an issue as well.
Mm-hmm. This was such a huge organizational movement. Can you tell me a little bit about that, the women deciding to win the vote by amending every single state constitution one by one? What a job.
It was an enormous job, and they went at it sort of with a two-pronged approach initially. There actually were two organizations formed in 1869. That's a complicated story. But in any case, there was an organization led by Lucy Stone and Julia Ward Howe, which went the state-by-state approach, feeling that that was the best way to get suffrage. And then the other organization, led by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, felt that the only way to go at it was to add an amendment to the Constitution. So it was really a two-pronged approach, and that's exactly what happened, was that eventually with the second generation of suffragists, they continued to work both on the state level and the national level. But finally, in the last few years, the attention was really on the national level.
Mm-hmm. And I would say in Wisconsin, from what I've seen from the Wisconsin Historical Society, there was a shift here, I guess, in around the 1890s, where people went from a more radical approach to advocating for suffrage to a more incremental, let's just make this part of larger civic reform and focus less on women specifically. And women's clubs kind of broke away and formed different kinds of campaigns for more women's rights in general, and kind of downplayed the suffrage for a while. And I don't know if that was part of the national movement as well, but certainly here in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. You may as well tell the story right now of how Wisconsin happened to be the first state to pass the 19th Amendment. It was right down, it was down to the wire, right?
Well, yeah, and Professor McMillan can correct me if, you know, Wisconsin's rah-rah version of history is a little off. But I like to tell the story because
that never happened.
It is a very fun story. So Wisconsin and I think Illinois and possibly, oh boy, maybe Michigan, all ratified on the same day. And Wisconsin, being 1920, sent off their papers by, you know, speediest trains to Washington to file them with the federal government. And the story in Washington, or the story in Wisconsin, goes that when Wisconsin's messenger was delivering his papers, he was leaving the federal building only to encounter the Illinois messenger just arriving. And so he proudly returned to the state carrying his time-stamped certificate verifying that Wisconsin was indeed the first state to have its ratification officially recognized in Washington.
Hmm.
That's great. And, of course, we have to remember that some states already had, women already had the right to vote.
That's a different story, yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole other story, right. But this, there had been some success in getting suffrage for women, particularly in the western states. That's where suffrage came first.
Why?
I live in the state that could have been the 36th state to ratify the amendment and, you know, finally, you know, added it to the Constitution, but North Carolina was dead set against it. And, in fact, Tennessee and North Carolina were voting on the same day, and the legislators here actually sent a telegram after they defeated it to Tennessee, urging them to defeat it as well. But fortunately, Tennessee.
Oh, the Tennessee story is a great one, too. Tell us that one.
Yes, with the man, the young man, who was, I think, the youngest man in the state legislature, whom everybody thought would, of course, vote against the amendment. But his mother sent him a note saying, you know, do the right thing, son. And so he voted for the amendment, and Tennessee became the 36th state.
And there's a great story that I read that he apparently had to creep out on the third floor ledge of the state house to escape the other anti-suffragist lawmakers who were so angry with him.
Oh, my.
And I think it took him a few minutes to really register that unexpected response and its implications.
Right. And what was it about the western states? Why were they a little bit more progressive in this area?
Well, I think it had to do with the role women played out west. They were such important partners in, you know, in settling the West, in bringing reform. And I know in the case of Wyoming, which was actually the first territory and then eventually the first state to give women full suffrage, the whole amendment, the state amendment for women's suffrage, went through the legislature very quickly. So there was really no time for opposition to organize. But also there was a sense that, you know, first of all, Wyoming didn't have that many people, and it was trying to encourage, families to move there. And this was a gesture to sort of show that Wyoming was a very, tolerant state, a very welcoming state of women and all that. So it went through the legislature very, very quickly. Utah was the second place, which is always interesting with its Mormon majority. So, but overall, I think there was just women occupied a different sort of place in society out west. And for instance, some of the earliest universities that were open to women were out west as well.
I think that some of the I was reading last night Sojourner Truth's message to the Women's Rights Convention in Akron in 1851, where she talks about "Ain't I a woman?" And that was one powerful message too. When you talk about women doing all things in the West, and her story too, and the number of children who went into slavery she had, and how she was a strong woman in many ways, but she could do virtually anything a man could do physically.
Yes, I mean, she really stands out as one of the few African-American women who was totally involved in this movement, because for the most part, this was a middle-class white movement, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But she really stands out for an important role. I do want to correct the historical narrative of that speech. She said something to that effect, but the actual speech, the way we know it today, was rewritten by a white female abolitionist, and she's the one who created those ringing phrases. That's not to discount Sojourner Truth's involvement in the movement, because it was profound. And as I say, she articulated similar thoughts. It's just the actual wording was rewritten later.
Hmm. And why was it primarily a middle-class white women's movement?
Well, I think because, first of all, white women were well-educated, and they were getting, you know, many of them were getting very good educations by this time. Lucy Stone was one of the first women to graduate from college. She went to Oberlin Collegiate Institute, now Oberlin College. So I think education had a lot to do with it. I think also the fact that many of these women were involved in reform efforts. There were all kinds of concerns this nation had, and women were engaging in these reform efforts, forming organizations, learning how to petition, learning how to make their feelings known. A lot of the women involved in the very earliest efforts at suffrage were Quakers, because Quakers, of course, believed that everyone is equal in the eyes of God. So these were women whose concerns were already very, very public, and that just sort of translated eventually into women's rights.
I think that was exactly the same in Wisconsin. Women were very active. The women who worked on suffrage were also very active in things like public hospitals, public education,
yes,
poverty reform, civic reform. So they already had those networks, and they had some influence among their husbands, their brothers, their fathers, who were in many cases business leaders or politicians themselves.
Hmm. Well, let's welcome phone calls. We'll do that momentarily. We're talking about the 90th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which we are marking this month. Oh, no, it was last month. It's September, isn't it? Oh, we tried to do this last week, but we couldn't. So we're marking it just a little bit late. August 26th was the exact date, but it's 90-year anniversary this year. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and our guests are Professor Sally McMillan, Mary Reynolds Babcock, Professor of History at Davidson University, author of a number of books, including Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement, and Christine Lidbury, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Women's Council. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Gil in Huchesford. Hi, Gil.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I heard about suffrage passing in the West at first, and I grew up in Montana, and quite proud that Jeanette Rankin was from Great Falls. But the role of why women's suffrage, I think, although we all like to look back and say that everything in America does is for the right reason, but unfortunately, the reason that in the West women's suffrage passed so early was it was actually a nativist and anti-immigrant issue that as the early Yankee settlers were being inundated with people from other backgrounds, especially if they not be Northern European, Western or Southern European immigrants, the non-Protestant, and in specifically in Utah, non-Mormon. So the nativists, the people that were in political control, as they saw their majorities dwindle, enfranchised their women to try and hold their majorities.
Professor McMillan, you want to start with that?
There is absolutely some truth to that. I'm not sure it applied to Wyoming, but the Mormon issue indeed was true, that Mormons wanted to retain their majority and their control of their territory. They also wanted to deliver a message to Congress. There was a lot of criticism about polygamy and Mormon faith, and they wanted sort of to deliver this message that they indeed were very tolerant and very open-minded. It did play. I know the whole anti-immigrant issue played a role in Colorado, to some degree in California. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on all the Western states, but I think it was a concern. I'm not sure it was universally true.
What about suffrage leaders here in Wisconsin? Did any of them become national figures? Are those that we, of course, would remember, and those that we may not know about that we need to remember?
Well, there's Carrie Chapman Catt, who is certainly very well known in the suffrage movement. She was born in Wisconsin, although later moved with her family to Iowa and was raised there. She, upon the passage of suffrage, became the founder or helped found the League of Women Voters and served as its first president. Lavinia Goodell from Janesville was Wisconsin's first attorney and was strong civic activist, in the 1870s, led a march, right on City Hall to get politicians to keep their campaign promises, to limit tavern licenses, and later worked very much on suffrage in that area. So there were several women, I think, who, and then there were quite a few women, probably not as well known nationally, from Wisconsin in the 1870s. I'm trying to roll through their names in my head. There was a woman from Theodora Yeomans, I believe, of Waukesha, and Ada James of Richland Center, were in the 1890s, were big suffrage activists in that part of Wisconsin and really worked a lot on civic reforms as well.
Mm-hmm. I had forgotten that Kat was born in Wisconsin. That's fabulous. certainly, I think we give her an enormous amount of credit for the final passage of the 19th Amendment. She was president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association and apparently a tremendous organizer. And
yeah, she was quite a skilled strategist, I think, in a way that was really unusual at the time for women to be able to work, have access, and apply their strategy to political causes.
Yeah, absolutely.
How dangerous was it to be a supporter of this movement?
I've never found, well, of course, my book primarily focuses on the 19th century, and there were times, for instance, when, say, a Lucy Stone or a Susan B. Anthony were out lecturing, and they would have rotten fruit thrown at them. In one case, Stone was hit by a hymnal. Protesters would come to these meetings and try to create all kinds of ruckus and basically try to shout down the speakers. So there was that went on, and then, of course, in the getting closer toward the passage of the 19th Amendment, there were purposeful efforts led by a woman named Alice Paul who, they would picket, they would march, they would shout, they would scream. They were trying to disrupt the whole political proceedings, trying to sort of challenge Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, et cetera. And they were imprisoned for brief periods of time. I'm not sure their lives were really in danger. But nevertheless, these women did face an enormous amount of resistance and, and certainly at least, shouts of concern and in a few cases flying vegetables and fruit.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Catherine from Iron River. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question regards, I cannot, in studying the history here, there was a state whose vote turned on a group of teachers who addressed the House of Representatives based on the fact that every single man there could lay his educational foundation on that of women teachers.
Hmm.
and that turned the vote. And I cannot recall what state or the woman who headed that group of teachers. This author,
Professor McMillan?
I'm sorry, I do not know, but I love the story. I think it's fabulous.
Okay.
And I'm going to try to look it up now that you've mentioned it.
Christine, are you familiar with that?
I'm not, but, you know, it makes sense to me that teachers, Professor McMillan was talking about, you know, educated women, middle-class women, although teachers may not have been, you know, square in the middle class, I think educated women who had a lot of resources in the community may well have been involved in...
The winning point they made was that every single man's success in that legislature body began in an elementary school and higher with women teachers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting, too, that, you know, education, when we talk about women's access to participating in education reform, having a voice in voting for people on education boards, and in Wisconsin, even being able, as early as, I think, the 1870s, being 1860s, 1870s, being able to be elected to serve on education boards, there were roles that were considered proper roles for women. And, you know, when women worked on public education or public hospitals, I think they were received with much more credit and sympathy than when they were talking about temperance or civic issues, broader civic issues.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for your call. We go next to Virginia in Janesville. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for the program.
You're welcome.
I went to the mural dedication. It was one of the most fabulous days I've had. There were women dressed as suffragettes handing out purple ribbons with gold letters saying votes for women on them, and wonderful speeches, and many people attended. The mural is three stories high. You can see it from wherever you ride around in Janesville, and it's just fabulous. But it was painted by a man, and I wondered why they, you know, it wasn't women artists, but that's a minor quibble. What I really want the women to talk about, on the mural, there are pictures of mill workers, because Janesville's cotton mills were two-third women, and I think that goes into the white middle-class women's movement thing. I think the white middle-class women who were heavily involved in charity, and I think that's a great credit to them, because they could have just done balls and cocktail parties and all that sort of thing, and they were building hospitals and libraries, and but the working-class women and the black women were involved. The working class women were working in the mills, and the black women were involved, I think, in the abolitionist movement. I would like the guests to sort of put it in context. When did the workers' rights movement begin? Where was the abolitionist movement, the feminist movement? How did they all interrelate to one another?
That is a huge question. Let me first deal with the mill workers you speak of. I would say that in terms of sort of strikes and you know, activity in which they're demanding more rights began, you know, in the 1820s and 30s. For instance, in Lowell and Waltham, Massachusetts, there were uprisings where, you know, the young women who were the majority of the factory workers, they did, you know, the weaving and the spinning and all of that. They went on strike in the 1830s. There were three different strikes in Lowell where they were demanding better wages, they were demanding more time for lunch, they were demanding better working conditions. So there was this collective activity that began almost immediately as soon as conditions began to deteriorate. And, of course, that whole labor movement continued well into the 20th century. So that was very much a part of women's lives. It's just that it was on a different level. But I do. There were conventions. There were national conventions held before the Civil War for women's rights, and in some cases, committees were set up to study the serious working conditions of women, the low wages they were paid compared to men, and the injustices they faced. So there was sort of an outreach effort, and a real concern, although all the work in terms of the actual movement was done by middle-class women. They had the time. You know, the working women are working. So So they obviously did not get involved in the formal movement. And then just quickly, in terms of the abolition movement, the women's rights movement really grew out of this anti-slavery effort because, again, these Quaker women were the primary activists in terms of the anti-slavery cause in the North. And there were both black and white female anti-slavery societies. I think the one in Philadelphia was actually integrated. But in any case, this idea of being able to speak out and being able to engage in this activity was, you know, sort of just automatically translated into a realization that women, when they went to speak in public, when they began to engage in petition activities, were put down by men. And they didn't have really the equal opportunity to engage in this very, very important activity. Two of the leaders in this effort, again in the 1830s, were Angelina and Sarah Grimke, who were Charleston-born, very wealthy Southern women who went north. They hated slavery. And they were the first women who played a huge role in speaking in public to both men and women, and that caused this outcry. And suddenly women were aware that, wait a minute, we are not as free as men, and we are trying to free the slaves, and we also need to try to free ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's almost a direct tie, I think.
And you mentioned Frederick Douglass, who was at that that meeting in Seneca Falls, wasn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
In the room.
Yes.
In the room.
Yes.
Let's go back to the mural for a moment. I'm not sure we've done it justice here yet, Christine, and we want people to go see it today
sure.
whenever they're in Janesville. It's three stories high, and what does it feature?
It features, there's a woman in the very front who has a sash, a Votes for Women sash. She's a suffragist who's right in the front. And then there are several scenes, and there are several women, including Lavidia Goodell, who's from that area, public hospitals, the founding of the public hospitals, the cotton mill where women made up 2/3 of the workforce, and I believe public libraries, the first public library founded by women in the Janesville community. And so it shows these different civic activities to kind of really put women in the historical narrative about women into context in that community and the role of women, which has not often been discussed, in really establishing the community around Janesville, the infrastructure, the civic life of that community.
We go to John next in Monroe. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really pleased with this program. People need to be reminded how recently it was that our own women had the right to vote. I spent 4 years in the Middle East teaching at a university over there, Sultanate of Oman, and I retired back here a few years ago to my native Monroe. And, of course, I follow with great interest the events in the Middle East and this tension between Christians and Muslims. And I keep hearing, gee, isn't it terrible how badly they treat their women? And I always remind people, look, yeah, we want to see progress over there, but it was only recently that our own women had the right to vote. And I think that most people either have forgotten or they don't realize how recently it was that our own women had the right to vote. And people need to be reminded of that.
I couldn't agree more. I just despair that I think fewer and fewer women, particularly young women, are interested in understanding this amazing history that this struggle, this fight. They are now in college and realizing they have all these great opportunities, and they do, but yet it was such a compelling story, and I just think we understand ourselves better if we can understand what it took for women to gain full rights as citizens of this country.
And having been in the Middle East, I look at it in the context of this controversy and our criticism of the Muslims. And again, yes, we want to see progress in that area, but we are so lofty and congratulate ourselves, and yet it's been a struggle here, and it's going to take time over there too. And we have to realize that.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, John, for your call. Well, we've got to remember our history in so many regards, right? We're just this instantaneous culture. Well, let's see what's going on today. What's going on the next minute? And you have to understand what happened before, I think, in order to live, in order to make decisions.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's pause for just a moment, and we will return. It is the actually August 26th. We're just a few days late in our celebration of the 19th Amendment, which was ratified on August 26th, 90 years ago. We have two guests with us to talk about what happened here in Wisconsin. There's been a dedication of a major mural in Janesville, Wisconsin, which we urge you to see, and actually I need to see it as well. Remarks were given at that mural dedication by one of our guests, Christine Lidbury, who's executive director of the Wisconsin Women's Council. Also joining us is Professor Sally McMillan, and she specializes in Southern and women's history and teaches at Davidson. She is the author of a number of books, including Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement. Our phones have been real busy, so just keep trying and you'll get through eventually. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Marie next from Jefferson. Hello, Marie.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm especially delighted to hear the topic today because I'm the niece of two women suffragettes. People who were in the suffrage movement and spent time in jail.
Oh, my.
I'm 73, going to be 73, and I had an opportunity to talk to them. And one of the things I remember very distinctly is that my one aunt, her name was Minnie Johnson, she said that women's status in this country was lower than a cow's. And I'll never forget that. So it hasn't been that long that women didn't have the rights that they have now.
And how did they happen to become imprisoned? Do you know the details?
Because they were marching for the women's suffrage rights, and they had pins to show it. In fact, at my one aunt's funeral, who was also Quaker, and I never knew there was a connection. Mentioned she got an award and everything. It was quite a women's group. So we had an opportunity to attend it, and I never knew the meaning as much as I understand it now.
Mm-hmm.
So
you should be
to
very
it.
Proud. That's
yes.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Yes.
That's a very exciting history.
It's probably influenced your life in some ways, hasn't it, Marie?
Oh, yes.
I'm sure.
Oh, yes. In fact, the one aunt, when she was in her 80s, marched to anti-war movements for Vietnam, and her picture was in the paper. I remember that. And they're from Iowa, but she was very active and read all the papers, newspapers that she could, right up until she died. She was in her 90s when she died and was living with my brother. And so it was. I am very proud.
Just
so
great,
thank you for the topic.
Activist.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Marie, for your call. Beth is next in Kenosha. Hi, Beth.
Hi there. I'm just wondering, I can't remember when, didn't they get the vote earlier in Britain? And then I'm curious about, like, the Scandinavian countries and, say, France and Germany. Do you have any idea about that?
I wish I had looked that up. I always forget. But, yes, England, I think, preceded us by a couple of years, although it was more limited suffrage in terms of, I think it was women over 30 who were first given the right to vote in England, and then later on that expanded downward to 21.
Okay. I was just curious because, I mean, you hear about, like, Scandinavia being so progressive, and I thought, well, I wonder.
Anyway, no, there were other countries that had gave women the right to vote before the United States. It was the first country was in the early 20th century. But we were not in the forefront. We were not the first by any means. So we had some catching up to do. But I can't remember what. There were a few European countries. I'm guessing one or two of them were Scandinavian countries. New Zealand. Somebody will call. I'm sure.
Rhonda's looking this up too, in case somebody doesn't. And more information here. Women in the UK given the right to vote on February 6, 1918. And you're right. It included women over the age of 30. It was in 1928 when the age was lowered to 21 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Rhonda. Thank you, Beth, very much for the call. We have some lines open. We've been very, very busy here, but our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 8655.
I wanted to mention, I pulled out my picture that I have of the Janesville mural, so I can tell you a little more specifically what some of the things are that are in there. It'll refresh my memory a little, since I was standing with my back to it for most of my my presentation. So there's a principal figure kind of in the center, which is a woman holding hands with a child. And she has a Vote for Women sash, and she's kind of an anonymous suffragist, kind of representing that period of 1860 to 1890. And then there are other pictures in the background that include the Janesville Cotton Manufacturing Company, where two-thirds of the workforce was female, and those were really tough jobs, working in those kinds of manufacturing companies during that time, very much sweatshop sort of environments with long, long hours. The first public library founded by a women's association in Wisconsin. Nellie Tallman, a leader of charity work, including establishing Janesville's first public hospital. And Lavinia Goodell, who I'd mentioned, who was Wisconsin's first female attorney, who also was very much a leader in both suffrage and other civic activist activities. And Angie King, who is perhaps Wisconsin's first woman to win elective political office. She served on a school board when women were allowed to be elected to school boards back in the 1860s.
And there's something that women are still moving, but slowly, into the arena of women as elected officials. You keep thinking the numbers will be somewhat parallel to what we are in the population, which is over 50%, right. but no doing yet, right, Professor McMillan?
No,
we're a long way from that. Yes.
Yeah, we track those numbers through the Women's Council for Wisconsin, and you know the numbers are really low. It depends on what level of government you look at, but you know the number of women serving in the state legislature is at its lowest level at about 22%, its lowest level in 20 years.
What's going on with that, Professor?
Oh, who knows? I mean, we have had a woman try to run for president. We have had a woman twice women have run as for vice president. But the numbers are really low. I think we have 6 female governors now. One of them happens to be North Carolina, and North Carolina also has a female senator. I think there are, 2 or 3 states that have both senators are female? But those are the exception. And, you know, it's troubling. And yet I also would like to say that there are other ways women have power. And while I think political representation is so important, I also feel that women work in other ways to, you know, exhibit an enormous amount of power, of changing society, et cetera. So I think just counting the number of representatives or how many people are governor, how many women are governors, is not nearly doing women justice.
Mm-hmm.
And also it takes a huge amount of money now, I mean, millions of dollars now to run for the House of Representatives. It's appalling.
It is appalling. Virginia in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Virginia. Go ahead.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
I just love your programs, as I do with all of them, Kathleen.
Thank you.
I'm commenting today, and I'm so glad I got on the lines because I know they're really, really busy. I have ancestors buried in Janesville. It came out of Janesville, and they are on my mother's maternal side. And I have a picture of one I got off the internet who was pretty famous at that time because she lived in the early 1900s and became one of the first women police officers in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were 6 of them. And it's pretty hilarious. I mean, she's got the long skirt on, of course, as they did in the early 1900s, and in the high shoes, etc., and button down shoes, and with holding the gun, kind of like almost holding a hanky, handgun, and you're thinking, and with a hat on,
of course.
And I'm thinking to myself, how could this woman chase a criminal of any kind, like in this state that she's in? But she also, this woman had her husband had passed, this ancestor, and she went to law school afterwards, and which was kind of unheard of. She had about 5 children to take care of on her own. And so I've learned through my own mother, through her verbal history, that we've got these firebrands on her mother's side, and that's what I've concluded, all these firebrands in women. And they came out of Janesville. And I'm putting all of this together as I listen to all of you speak, that, well, it sounds like it's all together. It's a puzzle kind of solved here. And I do have to go to Janesville to see this lovely memorial. And I also think, apparently you said they had a celebration there. I think there should be the celebration all over the U.S. on that particular day of the ratification of the 19th
Amendment. Thank you. Thanks very much for your call. Well, go ahead. Whoever wants to respond.
Well, I was just going to say that I think, you know, discovering that one of these women was one of the first female police officers is a fabulous tale. And, you know, women's history is a fairly new field of study. I mean, it goes back, of course, to the 60s. But nevertheless, we are gradually uncovering women like police officers and female photographers who made a name for themselves in the 1870s. And, you know, women who did amazing things, they need to be written about. We need to get them front and center so that they are a part of our history books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I really like about this mural. Its purpose really is to take missing people, women who have been missing from the local historical narrative, and bring them up to the surface and use that as a starting point for discussion. You know, what have other women done in the community? Who are their successors generation after generation? And it really is a great opportunity to start to have that discussion and to collect some of those great photos and stories and build that oral and visual history in the community.
Yeah. Rhonda's been doing some. We should put these on Facebook, too. If you go to our Facebook page, we'll have more information for you about women gaining the right to vote. But it's 1906, Finland, the first nation in the world to give full suffrage, the right to vote, and to run for office to all citizens, including women. Switzerland, the last Western republic, women could vote in the constitutional monarchy of Liechtenstein. They could not vote until 1984, and women did not gain the right to vote in federal elections until 1971. So,
oh my God,
interesting history there. And Rhonda will post more of that. Were there major celebrations in the country on the 90th anniversary?
Sure.
There was in Charlotte.
Was there?
I know the National Women's History Project really celebrates this every year and provides resources to anyone who's looking for them to run events in your community. But I know that it was something that, you know, I saw emails even just in Wisconsin. There was a big event in Madison. I'm sure there were events in other parts of the state. And in many big cities, there are events celebrating this day, even on non-big historical years. It's one of those ones that I think it really inspires a lot of people. And I think some people do have a hard time relating to this kind of long-ago political struggle that has interesting stories but doesn't seem very relevant to what we do today. But I think, you know, when we put it in the context of when women had the right to vote, and, you know, I would go back to that issue of women in elected office. I understand that just counting the numbers doesn't always tell us the true story of women's leadership, but I think not unlike suffrage, there are places where it's okay for women to be leaders, and there's places where, as a culture, we're still a little unsure about that. And despite the fact that we see women at very high levels running for president, as our lieutenant governor here in Wisconsin, as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Wisconsin, and an increasing number of women on the Supreme Court in Washington, mm-hmm. when you go to local government, you don't see as many women in local office, and you don't see those numbers increasing. The thing about tracking those numbers is we can look at the trends, and we don't see them increasing from year to year. We see them being pretty darn stagnant over time, and I think that's true at the federal level, and it's true when we look at women in executive offices of big corporations. There's a great organization in Milwaukee called Milwaukee Women, Inc., which tracks women serving on boards of directors and as executive officers of big public companies. And, you know, it's about 12%. It's not a big number. And I think that's a lesson that we carry forward. Where are women allowed to be leaders, and what do we need to do to move that forward?
Yes.
There's a lot more to do, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Not
right
there yet.
We have a minute left, so just be aware that everybody. Jeff in Superior, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And my family back, you know, in the 1920s, my grandpa's sister, Myrtle Hillstead, went to Columbia University, got her PhD, and came back to Superior and taught in the Wisconsin Teachers College for, you know, 40 years and retired. But she was in New York, and she was protesting, and she was there when they passed the amendment, and we're pretty proud of our connection to that piece of history.
Mm. Great story.
Great.
It is a great story. Is your book still widely available? This has made us all hungry for more information, Professor McMillan.
It is. I think you can get it on Amazon. You can order it through Oxford University Press. Yes, it is. It is in paperback. In fact, I think people are beginning to use it in courses. I use it in my history courses.
Okay.
I happen to like it. And it tells a great story.
Well, by golly, you should like it. And we're glad you wrote it. Thank you so much. Happy anniversary. Happy birthday to the 19th Amendment. And thanks for joining us for this conversation. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah, thank you. Our guest, Professor Sally McMillan. She is at Davidson University, where she is Babcock Professor of History, specializes in Southern and women's history, and the book that we were referencing, Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement, published by Oxford University Press in 2008. We should also say that she won the 2000 Hunter Hamilton Love of Teaching Award. And also joining us this hour, Christine Lidbury, who gave remarks before the Janesville Women's History Mural Dedication on Women's Equality Day, August 26, 2010. She is the executive director of the Wisconsin Women's Council. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production. Go to our Facebook page where there will be more listings about interesting facts worldwide concerning the history of women voting. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. So until tomorrow, thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.